I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 21st of April. All things political Mondays at 1 o'clock, and Molly Ball is our guest this hour, staff writer who covers national politics at The Atlantic. Recent articles include Ted Cruz is beating Rand Paul in the Tea Party primary. Can clever campaigns save the Democrats in 2014? She writes about the courting of Sheldon Adelson. Asks if Obamacare has turned the corner, writes about the religious rights' failed gay marriage backlash. We'll be welcoming phone calls on all of those topics and more during this hour, starting with the Affordable Care Act. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Molly. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with the Affordable Care Act. The president saying last week, this thing is working. I don't think we should apologize for it. I don't think we should be defensive about it. I think there's a strong, good, right story to tell. And yet the Democrats don't seem to be at least visibly telling the story. Why are they backing away?
Well, the polls still show that the public views the law negatively, and I think also the intensity of opposition is much greater than the intensity of affection for the law, at least at this point. I think Democrats are sitting on their hands a little bit out of nervousness. There's a sense that this thing could get better now that it seems to be on track, but they took such a beating for it in the fall when the website was such a disaster. The polls, even as they're starting to creep up now, are still negative, and so many of these vulnerable Democratic incumbents are in really tough territory in pretty deep red states that they're happy to have the president going out and selling it. They've been wanting him to do that for a while, but I don't think a lot of Democrats are ready themselves to be seen as embracing it.
Molly, how long does it take for major policy change like that to settle in?
Well, you know, a lot of people are still arguing over the New Deal. It's possible that we'll never stop having this argument, right? But there is a sense, and I think this is part of what Republicans have been so afraid of and why they pushed so hard to the point of shutting down the government last fall to stop it from being implemented, was because they realized that once something becomes part of the fabric of American society, once people are dependent on a program, mm-hmm. it becomes very, very difficult to take away. So now when Republicans talk about repealing Obamacare, Democrats can come back and say, you're talking about taking health insurance away from this many millions of people, and that becomes a much harder sell than if you're just preventing something that hasn't yet taken effect.
Do the Republicans, before the presidential election and perhaps before the midterms as well, have to come up with a detailed plan that they can unite behind and then sell?
You know, I think they missed an opportunity to do that, although it's obvious what sort of structural obstacles there were to Republicans doing such a thing. On the one hand, you have a camp of sort of policy-focused, perhaps establishment Republicans who believe that the party needs to present a more constructive image and believe that this relentless drumbeat of just Obamacare is bad is going to get old if the party can't offer an alternative. On the other hand, you have some Republicans, especially the sort of right wing of the party and Ted Cruz and so on, who believe that any talk of fixing Obamacare amounts to a capitulation, and the most important thing is just to repeal it. You know, we did have the House Republicans saying earlier this year that they would introduce an Obamacare alternative bill. They haven't done that, and it seems like that will be an impossible thing for them to unite around. The problem is, you know, if they're just talking about Obamacare is bad, they're with the majority of the public on that. Once they start talking about what they would do instead, then their opponents can pick that apart and can say, well, here's what that would do, or here's how this would be worse, and can characterize it in various ways.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I'm wondering what public opinion is on this now. You mentioned in your article an ABC Washington Post poll that showed public support at the highest level ever, 49% in favor of the Affordable Care Act, 48% opposed. But you go on to say that this poll could be an outlier. Do we know where the public stands on this?
Well, all the evidence we have so far is that that poll is an outlier. It will be interesting to see whether and how the polling moves in the coming months. But I included in that article a chart of a bunch of different polls taken around the same time. And most of them had Obamacare being more unpopular than popular by an average of about 11, 12 points. So the one poll that showed it more popular than unpopular by a single point looks very anomalous in that landscape of dozens of polls. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is much less unpopular than it was back in November when the website rollout was going on and it just looked like a complete disaster. And there has been a lot of good news, a steady amount of good news. We have the enrollment target being reached and exceeded, and, you know, just the lack of the sky falling. I think there are a lot of people who are going to look around and say, oh, the death panel didn't come for my grandmother. Maybe this thing isn't so bad. And so, on the other hand, you do have a relentless barrage of negative advertising from groups like Americans for Prosperity, the group backed by the Koch brothers that has been airing these anti-Obamacare ads relentlessly in a lot of the states where there are competitive elections. So that could influence the public's view as well.
So if the Democrats aren't fully behind talking about the initial successes of the Affordable Care Act, what issues do they want to run on?
Well, almost any Democrat you talk to will take the first opportunity to change the subject. And there are a lot of things they want to talk about. We heard in the past couple of weeks rolling out of an equal pay bill. They want to talk about women's issues. They want to talk about equal pay for women. They want to talk about the minimum wage. They want to talk about a variety of especially economic topics, anything but healthcare. But, you know, I keep talking to Democrats about this and asking my Democratic sources, what do you think is the right way to message this? What is the best approach for Democratic candidates to take in the midterms? And they're really all over the map. You have some Democrats saying, we own this. We have to embrace it. We can't keep running away from it because the public isn't going to believe that. Others saying this is just toxic. We need to run as far away from it as possible. So I think there's no unity on the Democratic side. Different Democratic candidates are probably going to take different messages with regard to the law.
It's rather ironic, Molly, isn't it, that what, if it is successful, years from now could be considered the signature piece of legislation from President Obama is something that Democrats are running away from right now.
Well, that would be an irony. But, you know, I think there's a school of thought that says that change is hard, change is destabilizing, and even when you make a positive change in terms of policy, inevitably there are going to be years and maybe even decades of jitters about it as you mentioned before, takes a while to sink in and become a part of society that's accepted. And in a way, that's quite natural. It's just the way policy change has to happen.
Before we move on to Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, you heard them speak recently in New Hampshire, I believe. Let's look at where things stand now. It's hard. A lot of people are saying Nate Silver is the guy we've been watching pretty closely because he tends to be spot on with a lot of his poll numbers. He has forecast, you write in one of your articles, of a narrow Republican takeover in the fall. You say a good election day will be one in which the Democrats hang on to, they'll barely manage to hang on to the Senate. When looking at the recent past, do we have anything that can give us an indication of where the Senate is going in 2014 midterms?
Well, I think the picture is very mixed at this point, and this is sort of what Nate Silver said in his forecast as well. It is very funny to me that, you know, back in 2012 when Nate Silver was forecasting that there was almost no way Obama could lose the presidential election, Democrats loved him and embraced him, and he was their hero. Now that Nate Silver is saying there appears to be a marginally greater chance that they lose the Senate than not, suddenly, Democrats don't like him so much anymore,
right.
And they're rushing to point out that he has, in fact, been wrong on occasion in the past. I think there, you know, and what he says is there's almost an equal chance it goes either way. Democrats are almost certainly going to lose seats just because so many of their incumbents are vulnerable. And that makes sense. If you think about it, Senate terms are 6 years long. So the last time all of these senators were elected was 2008, when Obama rode to victory on the strength of a huge Democratic wave. And a lot of states like North Carolina that don't look like blue states today were won by Democrats. So it's just inherently tough terrain for them. And I think it's going to depend on a few things. It's going to depend on whether things quiet down on the Obamacare front and there aren't sort of new explosions of bad news for Democrats. It's going to depend on whether the economy continues to chug along or even picks up speed. All of those are sort of the fundamental factors. And also whether the president manages to get more popular. Obama is quite unpopular now, and the sitting president's approval rating is one of the biggest factors on sort of partisan lean of Senate races.
You did an interesting piece, Can Clever Campaigns Save the Democrats in 2014? You went to a briefing at the Democratic National Committee. They were to impress reporters, you write, with newfangled technology that they will use. Did you see anything that really was newfangled and extraordinary?
Well, yes and no. You know, we heard so much after 2012 about these whiz-bang technological devices that the Obama campaign had used to power them to victory. And also, of course, we heard how hopelessly out of date and backward Mitt Romney and the Republicans were. Those claims are always inflated a bit, right? Whoever wins an election is always a genius, and whoever loses is always sort of incredibly incompetent, no matter how close the election is. So I think that it was always a little bit disproportionate. But, you know, all that technology belonged to the Obama campaign, not to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic National Committee is now trying to bring that in-house. The strength that parties have on both sides is that they are long-term institutions that can serve as a storehouse for things like a voter file that work best when they are collected over time and continued to be built upon and updated. And a campaign, by its nature, is something that is put together and then is dissolved when the candidate wins or loses. I am not sold on the Democrats' claims that they are so far ahead in this race. Republicans have been doing a lot of things to catch up. I don't know if they will have their act together in 2014 or if they're mostly building for 2016. As a reporter, I try to be skeptical. These things are difficult to evaluate because you basically cannot see them with your own two eyes. And the proof may not even be in the pudding, because it's easy, again, after you win for whatever reason, to claim that it was because of these types of things when the reality may be completely different. So I think the point that I was trying to make in that story, though, was that Democrats sort of need a silver bullet, need a panacea, because the landscape is so stacked against them, because the terrain they face is so difficult, because a midterm election inherently tends to cause a fall off of exactly the type, the demographic groups that have been so crucial for Democrats in presidential elections, younger people, minorities in particular. So, you know, the only hope Democrats really have of changing the landscape that is so negative for them is to somehow change the shape of the electorate. And so they're hoping that these technological tools can help them boost turnout.
I've never understood fully, maybe you can help me understand this, why it is that older white voters who tend to be Republican show up for elections like midterm elections. They show up for lesser kind. No election is a lesser kind. It's the wrong word here. But they show up for elections that aren't major national presidential elections. And yet Democrats might, if they have somebody they're really behind. But the fall off that you mentioned tends to be more on the Democratic side. Why is that?
Well, you know, that's actually not a permanent feature of the electoral landscape. You may remember in 2006, Democrats won the midterms in a really big way, and that was what gave them the majority in the House and Senate. They then, of course, went on to lose the House majority in 2010. So it is not inherently the case that, you know, Republican voters are reliable and vote in midterms and Democratic voters are not. It's just the way things have been for the last couple years, and it's sort of a factor of the unique coalition, I think, that Obama has assembled, that it's sort of on the backs of these groups. And, you know, you can do all kinds of armchair theorizing about young people not caring enough about politics or not, being rooted in communities where they have kids and pay taxes or whatever. I try to view all of that a little bit skeptically. I think it's you can't generalize in quite that sweeping a way about what causes people to vote and why they would vote in one election and not another. But a presidential election is the most high profile national political event of its kind, and it is a national event, so everybody everywhere is hearing the same things about it. A local election has much more to do with a smaller community that you may or may not be paying attention to. And so if you are someone who is only an occasional carer about politics, you certainly will hear about the presidential election. You may or may not hear about your local election.
We'll move on to Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Molly heard both of them speak recently, along with Mike Huckabee, and I believe Donald Trump was there as well. It was a Tea Party gathering, and there was one of those aforementioned people who really wooed the crowd. We'll find out who it was and why that was the case, and welcome your phone calls as well. We're looking a lot at politics this hour of the program. We started with the Affordable Care Act, and I really am interested in your response to this. Should this be an issue? Because Democrats have been hammered on this due to the slow rollout, the really bad rollout of the Affordable Care Act, or has it begun to work for so many people that, by golly, if you're running for office, you ought to stand behind the president and say, this is a good thing and we're behind you? Or does it behoove them to go to other kinds of issues like minimum wage, like equal pay for equal work, et cetera? What should the Democrats be running on? Simultaneously, what should the Republicans be running on? Is it still, as Ted Cruz wants to do, the Affordable Care Act that needs to be hammered? Do the Republicans need to come up with another plan and start selling it before the midterm elections and certainly before the next presidential race? We'll talk about Republicans in a moment. We looked a little bit at technology and how certain computers are going to try to target people very precisely and looking through data very precisely. But it looks as though probably both sides are doing that. So what do you make of what we've talked about so far? We'd love to hear from you. And here's how you call us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on Facebook, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. To you in a moment. Molly Ball is our guest, and she is staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political right now. Molly Ball is our guest. She is staff writer who covers national politics at The Atlantic. We're welcoming phone calls for her. We'll take a couple now and then go to the event she went to in Manchester, New Hampshire, where people from the Tea Party were listening to hopeful Republican presidential candidates. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. What I wanted to call about this week was that an article that I read in This Week magazine, the April 11th issue, and this magazine in general, I think, tends to the more to the conservative than the liberal side. And under U.S. at a Glance, they had an article about a man in Wilmington, Delaware, and it said that the multimillionaire DuPont family heir pleaded guilty to raping his 3-year-old daughter, received no jail time because the judge decided he would, quote, not fare well in prison. And he pleaded back in 2008 to fourth-degree rape, which was a felony that could bring up to 15 years imprisonment, and he was ordered to seek psychological treatment and sentenced 8 years of probation. And it came to light this week because his ex-wife filed lawsuit accusing the 47-year-old of abusing both the daughter and their young son and using the family's wealth and position in the community to avoid jail time. And the lawsuit claimed that the man had admitted in 2010 in a lie detector test to sexually abusing his son since 2005 when the boy was 19 months old. Now, the average person listening to this program and having dealt with sex offenders as a treatment social worker in the prison system before I retired, I can tell you the average person would be going to jail over this. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And again, I just offer it as yet another example of an ongoing situation where the middle class and the poor get one standard of treatment and the rich get another. And I think it's a real problem, and I think people ought to look at it in terms of who they vote for.
Thank you very much for your call, Jim. Molly, is that kind of not that necessarily that case, but this, if you're rich, you get away with things, if you're poor, you don't. Does that translate into politics in some way that's meaningful for either side?
Sure. I mean, without commenting on that case specifically, I think there is a feeling among a lot of people that our society is not fair in that way, and that inequality, economic inequality, which by many measures appears to be increasing or at least stagnating, that's a real problem that our political system isn't addressing. And you do hear, I think, there's a wing of both political parties that has this sort of populist tone. It's very interesting. You do hear a lot of Tea Party Republicans, people like Ted Cruz, talking about the fat cats, mm-hmm. and taking on this sort of populist tone, perhaps in part to combat the impression that has dogged Republicans that they are the party of the rich. And then, of course, you have a wing of the Democratic Party, the sort of Elizabeth Warren, Bill de Blasio wing, that wants to talk very assertively about inequality and about doing something about that. And in that case, it generally means, you know, increasing taxes on the rich and increasing public spending on the sorts of services that might benefit those on the lower rungs of the ladder. And you have a sort of establishment wing of both parties that I think shies away from that. And the accusation would be then that this is the sort of that they're sort of speaking for big corporations. I think this sense of frustration, of anger, has increased in recent years. And besides its use as a political message, you know, I don't see that our society is changing in major ways that would satisfy those people.
Thank you, Jim, for your call. Bill in Chicago is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm fiscally conservative and socially moderate. And I think while it's great that we've exceeded the sign-up goals for the Affordable Care Act, I think it's a mistake to focus on just that one metric. And I wonder if either of you have a view on why it's so hard to get information out of the administration when it comes to how many of those 7 million were previously uninsured, how the coverage in terms of cost and deductibles measures up to what folks had before, and what, if any, impact is going to be on the rates coming out of the insurance companies as they resize their risk, and whether there will be, if the administration contemplates the need to make any subsidy payments directly to the insurance companies to cover any losses that they may have had. Why is it so hard to get those basic metrics out?
All right. Thank you, Bill, for your call. Can you get those metrics, Molly?
Well, I think the caller is right to point out that there is a lot of information we still need to really judge the big picture of whether or not this policy is succeeding. But as he mentioned, some of this stuff we don't know because it hasn't happened yet. We don't know whether or how much rates are going to go up because that's something that may or may not happen in the future. The metrics that we have seen so far have been that, in fact, the rate of increases in healthcare costs has begun to decline a little bit. Several public surveys now show the percentage of uninsured people in the population beginning to decline a little bit. Those are appear to be good news for the objectives of the health care law. But again, I think it's preliminary. It's too soon to judge whether all that can be attributed to the law and whether it will be lasting. Some of these things that the caller was sort of accusing the administration of withholding are things that we don't know because they're not – it's just – I don't think they have the administration – the information and they're not giving it to us. Things like whether people were previously uninsured, that's not something that healthcare.gov asks people when they go to sign up. Now, you can say, oh, they should have asked people because we would like to know that. But I don't believe that that's information that the administration has and is just refusing to give us. All these things are very complicated. The law was modeled on what was originally seen as a sort of conservative way to do healthcare reform, this market-based set of exchanges without a public option. So there's a lot of it that's in the hands of private insurance companies and is therefore not known to the government in the way the government would know if it were a single-payer system. So ironically, some of these supposed defects in the law that conservatives are now criticizing come from parts of the law that were intended to be more conservative.
Mm. Thank you very much, Bill, for your call. There's also, it's really amazing to me, maybe it's because it's so early, that you get these wildly different understandings of what's actually going on. It's obvious to me, just from doing a talk show, and we've talked about healthcare a lot on this program, the number of people who have called in who had pre-existing conditions, who can now get insurance, they have chronic diseases, they're significant. The number of young people who are now covered under their parents' insurance, it's obvious it's affecting some people quite positively, and they're very happy about this. In terms of some of those other interpretations of numbers, you have one side saying one thing and one side saying another thing. I think it just adds to public confusion about a bill that is fairly complicated. We don't do anything in an easy way when it comes to health care in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it, which is that the reason it's confusing is that it's a confusing thing. I don't think I don't think the mixed messages make it any or deceitful in some way, right? I think that it's a big complicated thing with a lot of conflicting true information coming out, right? There are people who aren't happy about it. There are people who are happy about it. It would be an oversimplification for us to paint a picture that was wholly one way or the other. And there's a lot that we still don't know because it has just started. So if people are confused, I'm with them. I'm confused too. And that's probably a more accurate way to view things than to have a very strong belief that it is either all good or all bad.
And I think probably one thing we can say is they haven't had the number of young people sign up that they need to have. It's better than what they thought, but it's not where it should be yet.
Well, yes and no. So the
administration. No, not even that one.
Sorry. I know I sound like I just can't give you a straight answer on anything. From what I understand, though, the number of people either under 30 or under 35, I'm forgetting precisely which, the benchmark was at 40% because that's the incidence in the population. The administration now saying it's about a third that they're getting, but that the experts believe is good enough to avoid the so-called death spiral. Mm. It does look like, they didn't need to hit that 40% mark for the rate of young people in the risk pool to be good enough that the rates don't start spiraling out of control. So, mm-hmm. But again, we are not going to know about big things like the composition of the risk pool and how it's affecting insurers' bottom line for a while now as this thing starts to actually be used and a lot of people, for the insurance companies, this is a really big deal. This is millions more people that they are now serving, and that's going to affect healthcare providers. That's going to affect everybody. And so the whole system is going to change in response to this in ways that I don't think we can possibly know yet.
Yeah, Molly Ball is our guest. We have lines open. We're very interested in hearing from you. The president has said this thing is working. He's asking Democrats to get behind it and say that they are supportive of the Affordable Care Act. What do you think about this particular issue? issue, which is still with us. There are Republicans who are running heavy-duty ads in some places now saying that this is really a bad thing. It's still being used as an issue that many Republicans will run on in the midterm elections. Is it a winning issue now, or have things changed a little bit when it comes to the Affordable Care Act? What do you think? Does it behoove Democrats to use other issues to just walk as far away from this as they can because it's controversial and talk instead about the minimum wage, or I don't know what they should talk about? And is it a good strategy for the Republicans to keep pounding on this because it has some problems? It is a legitimate target of controversy and attack. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Let's move into Manchester, New Hampshire, where you heard Senator Ted Cruz and you heard other senators, Rand Paul and other people who would like to gain the support of the Tea Party. Who was the hit there?
Ted Cruz was the hit, and I found this very interesting because, as I'm sure you know, Rand Paul has been laying the groundwork to run for president for quite some time now, and part of his sort of theory of the case is that he will be able to appeal to the Tea Party wing. He's written a book that positions him as the sort of spokesman for the Tea Party. He's delivered the official Tea Party response to the president's State of the Union. And in order for him to sort of break out of the little libertarian box that his father, Ron Paul, was in, he does need to broaden that support into other wings of the Republican Party. So I went to this event in New Hampshire because Rand Paul and Ted Cruz were both on the same program, practically back to back, and I was interested to see how they would be received, how this sort of group of Tea Party activists would look at these two guys if they had to make a choice between them, because if they both run for president, as they both seem to be gearing up to do, that's the choice that I think very conservative Republicans would be asked to make. And I couldn't find anybody who – I found one person out of more than a dozen that I interviewed who liked Rand Paul better. Almost everybody said they found Ted Cruz much more persuasive. The difference between the two speeches was very interesting to me. Rand Paul very much talked about sort of libertarian issues, talked about the NSA and surveillance, talked about broadening the appeal of the Republican Party by reaching out to new audiences and embracing issues like sentencing reform for drug offenders. So these are very interesting ideas, but they're not sort of Republican red meat, right? And the Ted Cruz speech was 100% Republican red meat. It was all sort of rah-rah, a lot about Obamacare, a lot about issues that conservative Republicans already care about. So while Rand Paul, perhaps commendably, is sort of trying to stretch people to think about new things, Ted Cruz is just telling them exactly what they want to hear. And you can call it pandering, but politicians pander because it works. And people seem to feel that Cruz was just much more on the same page with them. I think also they saw Cruz as a much more dynamic speaker. He's much more able to sort of command an audience with a sort of theatrical delivery. Rand Paul is definitely a better speaker than his father, but he is still I think he's very good one-on-one with people. He's very conversational and easy to talk to. But in the context of giving a speech, the audience members felt he just was not as personable.
Mm-hmm. But both senators would need to get the support of the Tea Party in order to fulfill their dreams of a Republican nomination.
I think that's the theory that each is sort of working on. If you think back to 2012, you had a number of candidates competing for the right wing of the party. And then you had Mitt Romney virtually alone in sort of the establishment spot, the establishment lane. I think John Huntsman sort of briefly threatened him there, but sort of fizzled out for whatever reason. So anyone in the Republican Party who considered himself sort of an establishment or a moderate or even a liberal Republican was going to gravitate toward Romney. The rest of the party, whatever percentage that is, was divided. So we saw these like weird boom and bust cycles where, you know, Michelle Bachmann wins the Iowa straw poll and then she's toast because everybody's looking at Rick Perry and then Newt Gingrich and then Herman Cain and whatever. So it's easy to foresee a similar scenario to that in 2016 if you have Cruz and Paul and maybe others splitting that conservative vote. Mm-hmm. It will be hard for any one of them to get enough Republican primary voters to actually win primaries.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike in Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, my thing is I'm so disappointed. I'll listen to Ted Cruz and I listen to Paul Ryan. They want to bash the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act happened because our insurance system was broken. It needed to be fixed. Now, either you can join in and help fix it, but if you're not going to help fix it, you shouldn't be beating something up that's needed for all Americans. We all should. If Rand Paul and Paul Ryan have health insurance, guess what? All Americans should have it. And until that issue, which is a very complicated and big issue, gets resolved, then these people here shouldn't be able to just throw stones without having anything at all in the background to say, this is what we're for or this is what we're against.
Mike makes a good point. It's a valid point. And I remember when these discussions were pretty much bipartisan. We had people at our microphones from business and from Republicans and Democratic communities, and everybody agreed we had a broken system.
Absolutely. And I think he raises another good point, which is that even though the Affordable Care Act is not popular, the idea of repealing it is not popular either.
Mm-hmm.
And you heard the president say last week, you know, the American people are tired of this debate. People are tired of fighting over this, and people don't want to go back to square one. People generally want the parties on Capitol Hill to come together and find a way to fix it. The problem is, of course, that the parties have vastly different views of what's wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we're going to see a bipartisan move to fix the Affordable Care Act anytime soon, because it is such a partisan issue. As you say, this used to be something, you know, the Affordable Care Act is modeled on what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts.
Right.
It was this model of health insurance reform was supposed to be the conservative way to do it. But it became very polarized during the debate about it. And as we all remember so well, Democrats pushed it through with zero Republican votes. And that sort of ensured that it would remain a politically polarized issue for as long as it was in place. I think part of the reason that Democrats in the Senate tried so hard to get some kind of Republican buy-in on it was because they realized that that would be the case. But when Republicans refused to go along, Democrats were too invested in the outcome to just give up on it just because Republicans wouldn't play along. So now we have this situation. But I think that does mean that it's much harder to work in a constructive direction,
right?
Because because those have become the battle lines, right?
Yeah.
Democrats are for it, Republicans are against it. End of story.
Right. Jan in Duluth. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Jan.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
Just a comment first. And you guys are talking so much. We need to get more people on to call, but that's not why I called. I was wondering. Why Bill seemed to think that somehow we or the government should subsidize the insurance companies because they're not making as much money. They have ripped us off for years by canceling us when we got sick and refusing to pay for things and not allowing us to get insurance. Why would we want to help them out financially? Just makes no sense to me.
Well, I could try and answer that. I'm not an expert on this aspect of the policy, but the Affordable Care Act actually does contain a provision that reimburses insurers for some type of cost overruns. Again, I'm not entirely clear on how it works. There was a period where Republicans were trying to paint this as like a bailout of insurance companies, and then it turned out it wasn't unfolding quite how they thought, and they sort of quietly dropped it. But this supposed help to the insurance companies is actually part of the Affordable Care Act. It's part of this incredibly complicated scaffolding of regulated risk that is intended to enable private companies to compete in a sort of regulated, publicly constructed healthcare system that then people are mandated to buy insurance from.
Thanks, Jan, very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Molly Ball is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political, which we always have on Mondays, and taking your calls at 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. At K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Molly Ball is our All Things Political guest. She is staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. And we go next to Ralph. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I'll bring out one point. There's so many things that have been touched upon, but I can recall when Bill Clinton ran for president, that his success was because he kept on stealing the Republicans' ideas and then supported them, and they didn't have anything to campaign on. And this minimum wage situation is exactly the thing the Republicans need to take the fire out of the Democrats. And I would think that whoever runs against Hillary Clinton or whoever it is should push that they are in favor of a raise in the minimum wage instead of looking like they're only all to take care of the rich people.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. What do you think of that, Molly?
I think it's an interesting idea. It is true that, I mean, part of the reason you hear Democrats talking so much about raising the minimum wage is that it does poll extraordinarily well. Even a majority of Republican
Yes.
voters in polls say they favor raising the minimum wage. So this is something that speaks to a wide swath of people. You do hear Republicans in private expressing a lot of anguish about the fact that they don't think their party has a lot of constructive policy proposals to offer. And has become, you know, especially in the congressional wing, mostly just about obstructing a Democratic president. And so you do have a lot of Republicans who worry that the party is likely to be quite successful in 2014 in the midterm elections just for structural reasons, because of the Senate seats that are up and because of the way the House districts are drawn. They can't lose the House pretty much, and they may well win the Senate just because of the shape of things. And then Republicans worry that whoever their candidate is in 2016, facing a different electorate, facing, you know, a national contest, is going to have a hard time for the same reasons that Mitt Romney had a hard time. And so they are pushing the party to modernize and to maybe move to the middle on some issues in order to avoid suffering the fate that Romney did.
Hmm. Thank you very much for the call. And should the Republicans win the Senate, it's hard to imagine there being much more of a stalemate than there is right now. But it's hard to imagine that anything would be done, would it?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I live in fantasy land, but I have this pet theory that things might actually get better in Washington.
Really?
Because, just hypothetically, if Republicans controlled both houses of Congress, I think there would be some pressure on them to actually pass bills that were realistic instead of just, you know, the 47th vote to repeal Obamacare. Because once they own both houses of Congress, if they actually pass something, it's up to the president to sign or veto it. If they move to the middle and do something reasonable that the president could support, then they get some credit for that. I mean, I think part of the reason there's no incentive for the parties to work together on Capitol Hill is that with the House and Senate divided, nobody really gets credit if they do anything. So there's no way for Republicans to win, really. So it is possible, it is at least theoretically possible, that you would have, you know, if Republicans do win the Senate, it will be because they won some campaigns in swing states. So there would hypothetically be some more moderate Republican senators who would be pushing the party to find ways to agree with Democrats and to find things they could do that would actually be constructive that the president might actually want to work with them on. Mm.
Jared on email wants you to clear this up for him, Molly. If Ted Cruz was born in Canada, how can he run for president?
I'm not a legal scholar. I know that there is a lot of question about this, and the answer is I don't know. But he certainly seems to believe that he could, and that particular clause of the Constitution has been questioned variously over the years, including when John McCain ran. So I'm sure it would be the subject of litigation. I think that because of his parentage, he was entitled to American citizenship when he was born, and that is all you need in mm-hmm. some in one view of this issue. But I'm not an expert on that, so I shouldn't speak to it any more than that.
You have to, don't you, Molly, sort of believe that anybody who's even entertaining the thought of running for president has that one taken care of. You know, they figure out that they're legitimately able to run for president, as Obama was, as Ted Cruz would be as well.
Well, I mean, clearly, Ted Cruz is an ambitious politician who I think would like to be president, and so it's also possible that someone who wants something is going to find a clever lawyer who will tell them what they want to hear. I just don't know. I'm only glancingly familiar with the case law on this one, so
right.
I don't want to.
I think you're going to hear more about it as the time goes
I'm
by.
I'm sure we are.
Yeah.
Yep.
Earl in Tennessee. Hi. Earl, are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go. You go ahead, Earl. It's your turn. Go ahead.
I just about this Affordable Care Act. I was going to swap jobs, my own insurance. I pay about $8,000 a year right now, and I could go and get this Obamacare. And all said and done, he'd be about $18,000 a year, counting the deductibles and everything. And how can they call that affordable?
Is that for just you, Earl, or for you and a family?
Well, me and my wife.
Uh-huh.
It was going to be $6,250 a year for the insurance, $6,250 deductible for each, myself and my wife. So that's over $18,000 a year, basically what it would cost. And right now I pay about $4,000 a year for the insurance and a $3,000 deductible.
Uh-huh.
So our right at $7,000, so $7,000 to $18,000, basically.
Yeah, well, that's like a whole lot of money. But what I've been hearing from people who have been trying to navigate a system, Molly, is that, you know, this is one of the problems with the complexity of a new law of health care in this country. It seems to me as though Earl ought to be able to find himself a much better deal, don't you think?
Well, I can't speak to Earl's situation specifically, although it did sound like he said that 6,000 plus 6,000 was 18,000 when that ought to be 12,000 if I'm not mistaken. But there's a couple things going on here. I think, first of all, affordable means you can afford it. So if you're rich, you can afford quite a lot. and it very well may be the case that a lot of rich people are going to have higher costs. And the way the law is structured, they will be priced out of the subsidies because it considers that affordable for them because they have enough money to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
There are winners and losers with this law. There are people who are going to be paying more under this law and required to pay more than they currently were, either because they had the choice to go without insurance before or because they were relatively young and healthy and therefore could get very low rates before, where the law sort of equalizes some of those situations. The other thing that I'm not sure about, that whether Earl was talking about this or not, is that Obamacare is intended to give people security by allowing them the continuity of having insurance whether or not they're employed. So you may well have very cheap health insurance from your employer, and then when you lose your job, you're out of luck. Part of the idea of Obamacare is to give people something that is affordable when they don't have a job, or when they want to leave a job and start a business, become an entrepreneur, be self-employed in some way. You know, our system right now, the employer-based system, makes it very difficult for people who either lose jobs or who want to strike out on their own.
Yeah. Molly, thanks very much. It was a great All Things Political. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, it was wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. Molly Ball, our guest staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. And she's written about all kinds of things recently, the Affordable Care Act, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz beating Rand Paul in the Tea Party primary. We didn't even get to a lot of the things she's written about, but she'll return and we'll talk more All Things Political every Monday at 1 o'clock. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thank you, Earl, for your call from Tennessee. And we have news coming up momentarily, and we have another hour of conversation. So stay with us.